to the world before the industrial age began. A gain was nice, but a loss was potentially lethal. Someone sneaks into your cave and takes your winter stock of dried buffalo meat, and you starve. Prospect theory explains why you feel terrible if you lose your watch, even if you have four other watches. You're mistaking it in your mind for your caveman's stash of buffalo jerky. Neurobiological instinct drives us, even as prosperity has spread and been democratized through industrialization, globalization, and enterprise. A bad winter is, blessedly, not a mortal threat to almost anyone in the industrialized world, or indeed most places in the world today, and that is getting truer by the year. Yet, we still have the urge to acquire more to get good feelings and to signal our success to others, and to avoid less to avoid bad feelings like fear and shame. It makes no sense in modern life to use our energies to have 5 cars, 5 bathrooms, or even 5 shirts, but we just want them. Neuroscientists tell us why. Dopamine, the neurotransmitter of pleasure behind nearly all addictive behaviors, is excreted in response to thoughts about buying new things, winning money, acquiring more power or notoriety, or for that matter, having new sex partners. The brain evolved to reward us for the behaviors that kept us alive and made it more likely to pass on our DNA. This may be an anachronism in modern life, but it is a fact of our lives nonetheless. Here's the problem. The equations in this chapter govern our dopamine hits for short-term pleasure, but they don't bring any lasting satisfaction. This is especially true as we head into the back half of life. Early on, when one has relatively little and a lot to prove, more worldly rewards can be temporarily satisfying. But as one ages, we start to realize that the satisfaction never lasts and the realization of futility sets in. Meanwhile, fear haunts us as we start to fall behind. Thus, psychologist Carl Jung noted, what is a normal goal to a young person becomes a neurotic hindrance in old age. My favorite illustration of this fact comes from Abd al-Rahman III, the emir and caliph of Cordoba, in 10th century Spain. Al-Rahman was an absolute ruler who lived in complete luxury. Here's how he assessed his own life at about age 70. I have now reigned above 50 years in victory or peace, beloved by my subjects, dreaded by my enemies, and respected by my allies. Riches and honors, power and pleasure have waited on my call, nor does any earthly blessing appear to have been wanting to my felicity. Fame, riches, and pleasure beyond imagination. Sounds great, doesn't it? But as he goes on to write, I have diligently numbered the days of pure and genuine happiness which have fallen to my lot. They amount to 14. Better math. To sum up, here are 3 formulas that explain both our impulses and the reason we can't ever seem to achieve lasting satisfaction. Satisfaction equals continually getting what you want. Success equals continually having more than others. Failure equals having less. Dissatisfaction is the malady that makes us chase our worldly rewards to ever greater heights. The futility of attaining satisfaction is one of the reasons that professional decline is so painful. Desperate to achieve enough to be satisfied, we find that instead we are going backward. We are slowly falling off the back of the hedonic treadmill. In our hearts, we know this, of course. But even with this knowledge, the problem seems unsolvable. One astonishing proof of this is that the inventor of the term hedonic treadmill, Philip Brickman, the celebrated psychologist also responsible for showing that winning the lottery brings no lasting satisfaction, died by suicide, throwing himself off a building across the street from his office at the University of Michigan. Or consider the entrepreneur Tony Hsieh, founder of the online retailing pioneer Zappos and the author of the mega bestseller Delivering Happiness. He died in 2020 at the age of 46 after a long period of drug abuse and other self-destructive behavior, resulting in at least 1 911 call in which he threatened self-harm. But before you abandon all hope, I have good news. Satisfaction is possible, just not with the old formulas. We need to toss out all that bad math and use this one equation instead, which incorporates the wisdom of Siddhartha and Thomas and the best modern social science. Satisfaction equals what you have divided by what you want. Your satisfaction is a fraction, where the numerator is what you have, and the denominator is what you want. Notice the difference from the earlier equations? All the evolutionary and biological formulas focus us on the numerator of our haves. If you are unsatisfied in life, that's what you most likely have been doing all these years. But that ignores the denominator of the equation, the wants. As you increase your haves without managing your wants will proliferate and sprawl. You can easily be less and less satisfied as you move up the success ladder because your wants will always outstrip your haves. And when they do, your satisfaction will fall. I have seen this 100 times. Someone sees tremendous material success but feels less and less satisfied the richer and more famous she gets. The Mercedes brings her less satisfaction at age 50 than the Chevy did at age 30. Why? Because now she wants a Ferrari. She doesn't even know what's going on. She always just gets back on the treadmill and starts running, running, running. The world is full of clever ways to make your wants explode without your realizing it. Remember, when you keep running on the treadmill, people are making money because you're trying to satisfy ever greater wants with more and more haves. No one is safe. Even arguably the world's most enlightened man, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, admits to it. Sometimes I visit supermarkets, he says. I really love to see supermarkets because I can see so many beautiful things. So when I look at all these different articles, I develop a feeling of desire, and my initial impulse might be, oh, I want this. I want that. This isn't sinister. Corporations are not responsible for our satisfaction. We are. And that means not trying fruitlessly to get ahead on a speeding treadmill by falling over and over again for marketing gimmicks. It means turning the treadmill off by managing our wants. In the words of the Spanish Catholic saint, José María Escrivá, he has most who needs least. Don't create needs for yourself. Ask why, not what. If you are ready to manage your wants, to start chipping away, the first step is to ask what exactly needs chipping. And that raises the question, what is my why? The best-selling author and speaker Simon Sinek always gives people in search of true success in work and life the advice that they need to find their why. That is, he tells them that to unlock their true potential and happiness, they need to articulate their deep purpose in life and shed the activities that are not in service of that purpose. Your why is the sculpture inside the block of jade. Most people spend their time on the what of their lives. They can't see beyond the brushstrokes they put on the canvas. For example, I often see myself as college professor or guy who writes books or something like that. Others can focus only on the what's of their daily lives. Consider this email I received from a successful 50-year-old journalist. My best friend and I often ask each other, aren't we going to regret that we didn't enjoy this time in our life more? We agree that we will, and then we hang up the phone and go back to the madness. I don't think anyone wants madness, but we want nice houses and schools and vacations and organic food and college and church and sleepaway camp, and then you become tied to your circumstances. Consider what she's saying. She knows that happiness comes from seeing past these distractions, but it's too complicated, too disruptive of ordinary life. So she never sets about making the changes she needs to make to achieve the happiness she knows she wants. The same day I got that email, I received another from a person in very similar life circumstances, a 50-something-year-old woman, professionally very successful, who struggled with attachments. Then she got a wake-up call from her dead father. I no longer feel the need to surround myself with stuff, especially after my father died in his house and the paramedics almost couldn't reach him because his house was so full of stuff. That was a great lesson to learn. Her father was unreachable in death because of his physical clutter. My correspondent asked herself whether she was unreachable due to the psychological clutter of a life spent building up a huge boulder, leading her to start chipping away the what's to find the why. I have heard this story over and over. People don't realize their unhealthy attachments in life until they suffer a loss or illness that makes the important things come into focus. Researchers have consistently found that most survivors of illness and loss experience post-traumatic growth. Indeed, cancer survivors tend to report higher happiness levels than demographically matched people who did not have cancer. Talk to them, and they will tell you that they no longer bother with the stupid attachments that used to weigh them down, whether possessions or worries about money or unproductive relationships. The threat of losing their lives prematurely took a jackhammer to the jade encasing their true selves, the why of their lives. But you don't need a tragic loss or health scare to start this process. Recently, I met Luther Kitahata, a 55-year-old entrepreneur from California. Luther isn't world famous, but he has lived the American dream. His parents are immigrants who pushed him to learn a lot, work hard, and succeed, which he did. He became a computer scientist and started 7 companies. All through his career, he ran hard on the treadmill of success, pursuing the extrinsic rewards, and he got them, only to be immediately unsatisfied and start running again. Finally, around age 50, feeling frustrated and empty, Luther started chipping away at his wants. "My brain hadn't been wired to be motivated by passion, meaning, and purpose," he told me. "My brain had been previously wired to be motivated by fear." It took a few years, but Luther ultimately walked away from his old career and now coaches others on how to rebuild, perhaps debuild, their lives. He also spends more time with his family and developing his spiritual life. There's less money, power, and fame, to be sure. However, he finds himself satisfied for the very first time. Luther successfully jumped onto his second curve after he stopped adding and started chipping away. As he succinctly puts it, "I am loving my life." You can say this too, but you need to start chipping away, managing your worldly wants before more time passes. Remember, the longer you leave it, the further down your fluid intelligence curve it will drag you, and the harder the jump will be. The reverse bucket list. A second way to get started on the task of chipping away is to look at the counsel we get that is making us into dissatisfied homo economicus and simply doing the opposite. For example, self-help gurus often give you the advice to make an inventory of the bucket list on your birthday so you can reinforce your worldly aspirations. Making a list of the things you want is temporarily satisfying because it stimulates dopamine, the neurotransmitter of desire, which is pleasurable. But it creates attachments, which create dissatisfaction as they grow. Remember my friend I told you about earlier, who fruitlessly sought satisfaction by checking off all his items. As the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, the craving of one given to heedless living grows like a creeper. Whoever is overcome by this wretched and sticky craving, his sorrows grow like grass after the rains. Personally, I have gone in the other direction instead, by compiling a reverse bucket list to make the ideas in this chapter practical and workable in my life. Each year on my birthday, I list my worldly wants and attachments, the stuff that fits under Thomas's categories of money, power, pleasure, and honor. I try to be completely honest. I don't list stuff that I don't actually want, like a boat or a house on Cape Cod. Rather, I go to my weaknesses, which usually involve the admiration of others. I'm embarrassed to admit that, but it's true. I imagine myself in 5 years. I'm happy and at peace. I'm enjoying my life for the most part. I'm satisfied and living a life of purpose and meaning. I imagine myself saying to my wife, "You know, I have to say that I'm truly happy at this point in my life." I then think of the forces in this future life that are most responsible for this happiness. My faith, my family, my friendships, the work I'm doing that is inherently satisfying, meaningful, and that serves others. Next, I go back to my bucket list. I consider how these things compete with the forces of my happiness for time, attention, or resources. I ponder how empty they are by comparison. I imagine myself sacrificing my relationships to choose the admiration of strangers and the result down the line in my life. With this in mind, I confront the bucket list. About each item, I say, "This is not evil, but it will not bring me the happiness and peace I seek. I simply don't have time to make it my goal. I choose to detach myself from this desire." Finally, I go back to the list of things that will bring me real happiness. I commit to pursuing these things with my time, affection, and energy. This exercise has made a big difference in my life. It might help you too. Get smaller. A third method that helps break the habit of adding brush strokes to an already full canvas is to start focusing on smaller things in life. Voltaire's 1759 satirical novel Candide recounts the tale of the young and naive hero in his adventures with his tutor, the indefatigable optimist Professor Pangloss. The story is one of horror after horror: war, rape, cannibalism, slavery. At one point, Pangloss even has one of his buttocks amputated. In the end, they retire to a small farm, where they find that the secret to happiness is not the world's glories, but rather to focus on the little contentments, to cultivate our garden. Satisfaction comes not from chasing bigger and bigger things, but paying attention to smaller and smaller things. Buddhist master Thich Nhat Hanh explains in his book, The Miracle of Mindfulness, while washing the dishes, one should only be washing the dishes, which means that while washing the dishes, one should be completely aware of the fact that one is washing the dishes. Why? If we are thinking about the past or future, we are not alive during the time we are washing the dishes. We are either reliving a past that is dead or sucked away into the future that exists merely in concept. Only to be mindful, therefore, is to be truly alive. Once, my wife and I were at the home of close friends, eating and drinking out in their garden. It was dusk, and they asked us to gather around a plant with small, closed flowers. "Watch a flower," one of them instructed. We did so for about 10 minutes in complete silence. All at once, the flowers popped open, which we learned that they did every evening. We gasped in amazement and joy. It was a moment of intense satisfaction. But here's the interesting thing. Unlike most of the junk on my old bucket list, that satisfaction endured. That memory still brings me joy, more so than many of my life's earthly accomplishments, not because it was the culmination of a large goal, but because it was a small and serendipitous thrill. It was a tiny miracle that felt like a free gift, freely given. Looking ahead. I spent this chapter trashing the idea that the bucket list will bring you anything but dissatisfaction. Let me say one good thing about the conventional bucket list, however. It makes us focus on the limits of time and thus on how to use time well. The idea of the bucket list is to make sure you don't get to the end and say, "I'm not ready to die. I've never ridden in a hot air balloon." I didn't just make up this example. That's number 6 on the average bucket list, according to a 2017 survey. Death is the most normal, natural thing in life itself, and yet we're amazingly adroit at acting as if it were abnormal and a big surprise. When I tell my graduate students, who are mostly in their late 20s, to contemplate the fact that they have 50 or 60 Thanksgivings left and 20 or 30 with their parents, they look pretty shocked. And it's not just young people. Remember that the average American considers the beginning of old age to be 6 years after the average person dies. We avoid thinking realistically about the length of our lives and our time left, lulling us into the false belief that we have all the time in the world. This expunges the urgency of life changes, such as jumping onto the second curve. Planning for the end, then, is our next challenge and opportunity. Chapter 5. Ponder Your Death. A couple of years ago, I was having lunch with an old friend, a CEO who is almost exactly my age. I was telling him all about the research in this book, the inevitability of the decline of his fluid intelligence, and how hard it is for a lot of successful people to cope with. "That won't be my problem," he said. "Why not?" I asked. "I won't decline," he responded. "I'll just go harder and harder until the wheels come off." In other words, work, 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 croak. No second curve, because there's no need for one. I call this the rage against the dying of the light strategy to deal with the decline in fluid intelligence, named for Dylan Thomas's well-known 1951 poem, "Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night," which famously enjoins the reader, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Thomas was talking literally about death. He wrote the poem for his dying father. And indeed, people have been raging against death forever. I know what you're thinking. I'm not afraid of dying. Maybe, maybe not. Many psychologists would say you're deluding yourself if you say you aren't. But no matter, that's not my point. Rather, it's this. Have you ever said, "My work is my life"? If you have, then your fear of decline is actually a type of fear of death. If you live to work, if your work is your life, or at least the source of your identity, proof of being fully alive is your professional ability and achievement. So when it declines, you're in the process of dying. As a striver, it was your force of will and indefatigable work ethic that got you to the top of your fluid intelligence curve and profession in the first place. Raging is what you know best, but it fails at work just as it does in life. Ability based on fluid intelligence increases and then declines in every profession. Some earlier and some later, there are some key differences, but it is a misconception that decline can be delayed indefinitely in a profession just because it doesn't require physical strength. We saw that idea professions see decline too, generally decades before any dementia or senility. Only when you face the truth of your professional decline, a kind of death, can you get on with your progress to the second curve. If you don't, you'll be like my friend, trying to fight the inevitable, or at least hoping that there is some way around it. And to face this truth means defeating the fear of your own demise, literal and professional. This fear handcuffs you to your fluid intelligence curve. If you can master it, the reward is incalculable. It will set you free. But the only way to do it is by facing it head on. Understanding the fear of demise. The idea of death, the fear of it, haunts the human animal like nothing else, anthropologist Ernest Becker wrote in his classic 1973 book, The Denial of Death. A majority of people fear death to some extent, and most surveys find that about 20% have a high level of fear. Some people have a fear that is so extreme as to rise to the level of a psychiatric condition known as thanatophobia. Whether paralyzing or mild, the fear of death has 8 distinct dimensions. Fear of being destroyed, fear of the dying process, fear of the dead, fear for significant others, fear of the unknown, fear of conscious death, fear for body after death, and fear of premature death. The first of these is uniquely human. It is the fear of non-existence, the fear of being completely erased, the fear of being forgotten. My dog can feel fear when he's threatened, but as far as I know, he doesn't understand the concept of not existing because he doesn't know that he exists in the first place. Existential fear is not the stuff of biologists then, but of philosophers. While death is inevitable, it also seems impossible insofar as we cannot conceive of not existing. This creates an unresolvable, unbearable cognitive dissonance. Cambridge University philosopher Stephen Cave calls this the mortality paradox. The fear of decline involves the same fear of non-existence. If my existence in relation to others is defined by my professional accomplishment or standing, my decline will effectively erase me. Not surprisingly, the ways people deal with the crisis of non-existence are the same as how they deal with professional decline. Consider the case of Walt Disney, whose fear of death and decline was legendary. One day in 1909, the 7-year-old Disney was playing by himself in the backyard of his family's Missouri farmhouse. He spied a big brown owl with his back to him. Like any red-blooded boy, certainly like my boys when they were 7, he snuck up on it with the intention of grabbing it, thinking little about the consequences of actually succeeding in his objective. Once he got hold of the panicked bird, it predictably began to scream and claw. Now in a panic himself, he threw it to the ground and stomped it to death. The ancients thought the owl was a bad omen. In the year AD 77, Pliny the Elder said, "When it appears, it foretells nothing but evil." It was true for Walt Disney. That owl entered his dreams and haunted him for years. It created in him a morbid fear of death and colored even his many professional successes. Disney's first big hit as a young animator came when he was 26 in a cartoon featuring Mickey Mouse as Steamboat Willie. It had not only images, but synchronized sound, effectively ending silent cinema and ensuring Disney's future as an entertainment pioneer. But he immediately followed it up with another short feature entitled The Skeleton Dance, which opens with a terrified owl perched in a tree, followed by skeletons rising from their graves. Disney's distributor asked Roy, Walt's brother, "What's he trying to do, ruin us?" He went on, "You go back and tell that brother of yours the renters don't want this gruesome crap. More mice, tell him, more mice." This was a small sample of what was to come. As one scholar put it, if Disney was a mouthpiece for an American way of life, the force of his voice depended on a curious obsession with death. Virtually every one of his most famous films focused on the subject, from Snow White to Pinocchio. His personal life was focused on decline and demise as well. According to his daughter Diane, he thought about it so much that in his early 30s, he hired a fortune teller to predict when he would die. She told him he would perish at 35, obviously the worst news he could receive. Workaholic and success addict that he was, to distract himself, he threw himself completely into his work. If he stayed busy, maybe he could distract both himself and the Reaper. He survived 35, but never forgot the prediction. Shortly before his 55th birthday, he mused that maybe he had misheard, and the fortune teller had said 55, not 35. Do you really want to go on forever? Whenever someone asked my dad, "How's life?" he would always cheerfully answer, "Better than the alternative." If you live to work, you might give the same answer if someone asks, "How's work?" When you think about it, however, dying isn't necessarily the inferior alternative. Jonathan Swift made this point in his 1726 novel, Gulliver's Travels. In the nation of Lugnag, the hero, Gulliver, finds a small group of people, born at random, called Stroldbrugs. They look normal, but are immortal. What luck! This is what Gulliver thinks until he learns that while they do not die, they do age and suffer the typical ailments of old people. The only difference being that the ailments are not lethal. They lose their eyesight and hearing and become senile, but never die. At 80, the government renders them legally dead and unable to own property or work. They live forever as unproductive wards of charity, horribly depressed, and effectively invisible. This is fantasy in the case of physical death, but a pretty accurate picture for many people in professional decline. Have you met people who refuse to accept the fact that they are past their prime, determined to go until the wheels come off? They consign themselves to frustration and miss out on opportunities to change and grow. At best, they might avoid being forced out of their jobs in humiliation, but wind up as professional Stroldbrugs, ineffective and treated with a weird combination of pity and contempt by others. Okay, you might be saying, so going on too long isn't such a great idea. What about leaving an amazing legacy, so at least you won't be forgotten? This is the Achilles effect from Homer's Iliad. He had to decide whether to fight in the Trojan War, promising certain physical death but a glorious legacy, or return to his home to live a long and happy life but die in obscurity. As he describes his choice, "Two fates bear me unto the day of death. If I hold out here and I lay siege to Troy, my journey home is gone, but my glory never dies. If I voyage back to the fatherland I love, my pride, my glory dies." Achilles chooses the first option, giving him a mythic immortality that neither physical death nor decline could ever steal away. The Achilles of the Iliad was an invention of Homer, but many think this way in real life. One of the most common strategies to avoid the agony of being forgotten is by trying to engineer a professional legacy. In my conversations for this book, many people in the end stages of their careers talked about how they wanted to be remembered. But it doesn't work. They forget you. People move on. In the popular Jack Nicholson movie, About Schmidt, the lead character is a retiring, successful actuary, stunned to find that no one seeks out his advice. When he drops by the office to help out a few days after retirement, he finds them throwing all his old work in the dumpster. It's a scene with a lot of pathos, but it's based on truth. As one retired CEO told me as I was writing this book, in just 6 months, I went from who's who to who's he. The Stoic philosopher and Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius reminds us that our efforts at posterity always fail and thus are not worth pursuing. Some indeed have not been remembered even for a short time, and others have become the heroes of fables, and again others have disappeared even from fables. Remember this then, that this little compound, thyself, must either be dissolved, or thy poor breath must be extinguished, or be removed and placed elsewhere. It's notable that Marcus's words have persisted for nearly 2,000 years, so he is an exception to his own rule. But his point is still well taken, because you and I are no Marcus Aurelius, and sooner or later, even Marcus will disappear as well. And do you really think, even if they do continue to venerate your legacy, that it will be so great? Remember the hero on the plain. It was the invidious contrast with his past fame and glory, momentarily enjoyable, that made his current status so bitter. Finally, obsessing over the future squanders the present. I had an acquaintance who was extremely concerned with his professional reputation before death. Over the last few months of his life, when it was clear he was going to die soon, he spent most of his time finding ways to ensure that he would be remembered for his accomplishments. If you love your work so much, you might as well enjoy it while you're doing it. If you spend time thinking about and working on your legacy, you're already done. The right way to think about your legacy. There is one way to leave a legacy that will help you live better right now. In his book, The Road to Character, the writer David Brooks, a friend but no relation, distinguishes between resume virtues and eulogy virtues. Resume virtues are professional and oriented toward earthly success. They require comparison with others. Eulogy virtues are ethical and spiritual and require no comparison. Your eulogy virtues are what you would really want people to talk about at your funeral. As in, he was kind and deeply spiritual, and not, he had a lot of frequent flyer miles. The striver's life makes it hard to focus on eulogy virtues. We want to be good people, of course, but focusing on eulogy virtues feels just so not special. I have worked my whole career to do something better than everyone else, and I'm supposed to get distracted from that by doing things that anybody can do, like being nice? But here's the thing. You lose your edge on those resume skills, as everyone listening to this book either knows or fears. Meanwhile, the eulogy virtues can get stronger and stronger, all the way up the crystallized intelligence curve and beyond. Practiced properly, old people have an edge over younger people because they have more experience at life and relationships. Furthermore, keeping and building your eulogy virtues is inherently rewarding. You won't be around to hear the eulogy, or for that matter, how people talk about you after retirement, but you will live the most fulfilling life by pursuing the virtues that are most personally valuable to you. Think how short-lived a professional reward, a promotion at work, say, is compared with the fruits of generosity to a friend or family member. What gives you more satisfaction? An extra hour at work? Or an hour helping someone in need? Or perhaps an hour in prayer? Even if you are determined to build your eulogy virtues, the problem is that they keep getting crowded out by old habits and the daily grind. You don't quite get to that first hour listening to a friend because of that oh-so-pressing last hour of work. A few sages give a clue on how to sort this out. According to Leo Tolstoy, the worst thing about death is the fact that when a man is dead, it is impossible any longer to undo the harm you have done him or to do the good you haven't done him. They say, live in such a way as to be always ready to die. I would say, live in such a way that anyone can die without you having anything to regret. In short, imagine it's your last year of life, as well as of work. On the Sunday afternoon before the first day of each month, contemplate these questions. If I had 1 year left in my career and my life, how would I structure this coming month? What would be on my to-do list? What would I choose to not worry about? I am willing to guess that taking an extra work trip at the expense of seeing my spouse and staying late to impress the boss are not items that will be on your schedule. More likely, take a weekend away and call my friend will show up instead. This discipline helps us work on mindfulness, living in the present as opposed to the past or future, which studies consistently find leads us to be happier people. But it also helps us to make the decisions that truly expose our best selves. Tackling decline head on. To contemplate your eulogy, however, is the easy part. Now the harder part, staring right at your death and decline itself. This is what will truly eradicate the fear. There's really nothing novel about this advice. If you were morbidly afraid of snakes and went to a therapist, the most likely course of treatment would be snakes. Exposure therapy has been firmly established as the best way to take on fears and phobias. The reason is what psychologists call desensitization, in which repeated exposure to something repellent or frightening makes it seem ordinary, prosaic, and certainly not scary. If it works with snakes, it can work with death and decline. In 2017, a team of researchers at several American universities recruited volunteers to imagine they were terminally ill or on death row, and then write fictional blog posts about their imagined feelings. The researchers then compared those posts with writings by those who were actually dying or facing capital punishment. The results, published in Psychological Science, were stark. The writing of those temporarily imagining death was 3 times as negative as that of those actually facing it, suggesting that, counterintuitively, death becomes scarier when it is abstract and remote than when it is a concrete reality. The research is modern, but the concept isn't. In the words of 16th-century French essayist Michel de Montaigne, to begin depriving death of its greatest advantage over us, let us deprive death of its strangeness. Let us frequent it. Let us get used to it. Let us have nothing more often in mind than death. But exposure does more than just defeat fear. Contemplating death can even make life more meaningful. As the novelist E.M. Forster put it, death destroys a man. The idea of death saves him. Why? Simply put, scarcity makes everything dearer to us. Remembering that life won't last forever makes us enjoy it all the more today. It is a great irony about succeeding in the modern world that those who specialize in dominating fear, who rise to any challenge, concede no weakness, and meet any foe, are often desperately afraid of decline. But within this very irony resides a magnificent opportunity to beat fear once and for all, and thus truly to be the person you have made yourself out to be. If you ever visit Theravada Buddhist monasteries in Thailand and Sri Lanka, you will notice that many display photos of corpses in various states of decomposition. At first, it seems morbid and disturbing. As we now know, however, it is simply good psychology. It's exposure therapy. This body too, Buddhist monks are taught to say about their own bodies, such is its nature, such is its future, such its unavoidable fate. This is a meditation called Maranasati, mindfulness of death, in which the practitioner imagines 9 states of his or her own dead body. Number 1, a swollen corpse, blue and festering. 2, being eaten by scavengers and worms. 3, bones held together with some pieces of flesh and tendons. 4, blood-smeared bones without flesh but held together with tendons. 5, bones held together with tendons. 6, loose bones. 7, bleached bones. 8, bones more than a year old in a pile. 9, bones that have turned to dust. Like resistance to death, resistance to the decline in your abilities is futile. And futile resistance brings unhappiness and frustration. Resisting your decline will bring you misery and distract you from life's opportunities. We should not avoid the truth. We should stare right at it, contemplate it, consider it, meditate on it. I practice a version of Maranasati in which I mindfully envision each of the following states. Number 1, I feel my competence declining. 2, those close to me begin to notice that I am not as sharp as I used to be. 3, other people receive the social and professional attention I used to receive. 4. I have to decrease my workload and step back from daily activities I once completed with ease. 5. I'm no longer able to work. 6. Many people I meet do not recognize me or know me from my previous work. 7. I'm still alive, but professionally, I'm no one. 8. I lose the ability to communicate my thoughts and ideas to those around me. 9. I'm dead, and I'm no longer remembered at all for my accomplishments. There's a famous Zen Buddhist story about a band of samurai who ride through the countryside, causing destruction and terror. As they approach a monastery, all the monks scatter in fear, except for the abbot, a man who has completely mastered the fear of his own death. The samurai enter to find him sitting in the lotus position in perfect equanimity. Drawing his sword, the leader snarls, "Don't you see that I am the sort of man who could run you through without batting an eye?" The master responds, "Don't you see that I am a man who could be run through without batting an eye?" The true master, when his or her prestige is threatened by age or circumstance, can say, "Don't you see that I am a person who could be utterly forgotten without batting an eye?" One key difference between death and decline. "There's no greater misfortune than dying alone," wrote the Colombian novelist Gabriel García Márquez. What he meant, of course, was dying with no one at your side, which does indeed seem a tragedy. But of course, we all make the passage of death alone. As they always say about your possessions, you can't take it with you. But they could just as well mean your friends and family, as far as we know. That's one of the reasons people find it so frightening. But this is where the parallel between death and decline stops. With decline, you don't have to experience it alone. In fact, you shouldn't. The problem is that many people do decline alone. On their way up, they have let their relationships wither. So on the way down, they don't have a human safety net. This makes any change in the second half seem all the more difficult and risky. We can fix this, though, and it's our next chapter. Chapter 6. Cultivate Your Aspen Grove. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. Joyce Kilmer, 1913. It was a beautiful Colorado summer day in 2018, and I was in the early stages of thinking about this book. I was sitting under a stately aspen tree, with its leaves shimmering in the June breeze. A tree is a perfect metaphor for a truly successful person, it seemed to me. Trees are strong, durable, reliable, and solid. As the Book of Psalms describes a person who has achieved righteousness, "And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper." Strong, productive, and ruggedly individual. Whether one of a million in a forest or standing by itself on the savanna, a tree grows silently on its own, reaches its own heights, and ultimately dies alone. Right? Wrong. The aspen tree, it turns out, is not a solitary majesty, as I learned by sheer coincidence later that day from a friend who knows a lot more about trees than I do. He explained to me that each individual tree forms a part of an enormous root system. In fact, the aspen is the largest living organism in the world. One stand of aspens in Utah called Pando spans 106 acres and weighs 6 million kilograms. That lone aspen I was looking at was no such thing. It was simply one shoot up from a vast root system, one expression among many of the same plant. That got me to wondering whether the aspen was a special case. Later in the summer, I found myself in Northern California, in the redwood forest. The giant redwoods, Sequoiadendron giganteum, are the most massive individual trees on Earth. Not a single system like the aspens. Maybe this was a better metaphor for the rugged individual. Again, no. The redwood, which can grow to 275 feet tall, has remarkably shallow roots. often only 5 or 6 feet deep. It seems to violate the laws of physics that they can stay upright for hundreds, even thousands of years. That is, until you know one more fact. The redwoods grow in thick groves because their shallow roots are intertwined and, over time, fuse together. They start out as individuals and become one with others as they mature and grow. The aspen and the redwood are almost perfect metaphors for the Buddhist belief that the self is actually an illusion. We are all intertwined, Buddhist thinking goes, and our individual lives are simply manifestations of a more holistic life force. Ignoring this, the Buddhists feel, leads to living in an illusion and a lot of suffering. As Buddhist monk and writer Matteo Ricard puts it, our grasping to the perception of a self as a separate entity leads to an increasing feeling of vulnerability and insecurity. It also reinforces self-centeredness, mental rumination, and thoughts of hope and fear, and distances ourselves from others. This imagined self becomes the constant victim hit by life's events. No matter your religious views, the point is helpful and instructive. Humans are naturally interconnected, biologically, emotionally, psychologically, intellectually, and spiritually. Creating an isolated self is dangerous and damaging because it is unnatural. Just as seeing only the one aspen is a misunderstanding of its true nature, the lone person, no matter how strong, accomplished, and successful, is a misunderstanding of ours as well. We may look solitary, but we form a vast root system of families, friends, communities, nations, and indeed the entire world. The inevitable changes in my life and yours aren't a tragedy to regret. They're just changes to one interconnected member of the human family, one shoot from the root system. The secret to bearing my decline, no, enjoying it, is to be more conscious of the roots linking me to others. If I am connected to others in love, my decrease will be more than offset by increases to others, which is to say, increases to other facets of my true self. Further, my connection to others makes my jump to the second curve all the more natural and normal. Indeed, the crystallized intelligence curve is predicated on interconnectedness. Without it, my wisdom has no outlet. Establishing a root system isn't always simple, though. Many strivers have spent their adult lives under the illusion of their solitariness and now suffer the result. Their root systems are withered and unhealthy. Less metaphorically, they are simply lonely. The lessons in this chapter focus on how to build or rebuild a proper root system. We will first look at the evidence on love and happiness, especially in the second half of life. Then, we will take on the loneliness that so many successful people feel and how to meet it head on. Omnia vincit amor. In 1938, researchers at Harvard Medical School lit upon a crazy but visionary idea. They would sign up a bunch of men, then studying at Harvard, and follow them over their whole adult lives until they died. They would question them every year along the way about their lifestyles, habits, relationships, work, and happiness. Even though the original researchers would all be dead and gone, in a few decades, new researchers would be able to see how what people do early in life relates to how well or poorly they age. And thus, the Harvard study of adult development was born. The original cohort of 268 men included people from many walks of life, including some who went on to become well-known, such as John F. Kennedy and Washington Post editor Ben Bradley. Still, over the decades, it was deemed too demographically insular, all Harvard men, to give generalizable results, so it was paired with another data set called the Gluck study that had been tracking 456 disadvantaged youths from Boston starting at about the same time. Together, these data have been updated continually for more than 80 years. Fewer than 60 of the original participants are still alive, and the study is now tracking children and grandchildren of the first generation. The result of this study is like a crystal ball of happiness. You look at how people lived, loved, and worked in their 20s and 30s, and then you can see how their lives turned out over the following decades. The longtime study director, Harvard psychiatry professor George Valiant, wrote 3 best-selling books on the results. His successor, psychiatry professor Robert Waldinger, popularized the study even more with a viral TED Talk called What Makes a Good Life? Lessons from the Longest Study on Happiness, which has been viewed nearly 40 million times. One of the most interesting things that the researchers have done over the years is categorize the participants when old with respect to happiness and health. The best off were called Happy Well, who enjoyed six dimensions of good physical health, as well as good mental health and high life satisfaction. On the other end of the spectrum were the Sad Sick, who were below average in physical health, mental health, and life satisfaction. What led to being in each category? This is the million-dollar question for all of us, isn't it? The researchers found that some of the predictors were controllable while others aren't. Among the uncontrollable factors, uncontrollable by us at least, are the social class of parents, having a happy childhood, having long-lived ancestors, and avoiding clinical depression. Not very surprising or useful information there. Much more useful are the factors we can influence and that matter a great deal for late-life wellness. There are seven big predictors of being happy well that we can control pretty directly. Number one, smoking. Simple. Don't smoke, or at least quit early. Number two, drinking. Alcohol abuse is one of the most obvious factors in the Harvard study, leading to Sad Sick and putting happy well out of reach. If there is any indication of problem drinking in your life, or if you have drinking problems in your family, do not wonder about it or take your chances. Quit drinking right now. Number three, healthy body weight. Avoid obesity. Without being fanatical, maintain a body weight in the normal range, eating in a moderate, healthy way without yo-yo dieting or crazy restrictions you can't maintain over the long run. Number four, exercise. Staying physically active, even with a sedentary job. Arguably the single best time-tested way to do this is walking every day. More on that later. Number five, adaptive coping style. That means confronting problems directly, appraising them honestly, and dealing with them directly without excessive rumination, unhealthy emotional reactions, or avoidance behavior. Number six, education. More education leads to a more active mind later on, and that means a longer, happier life. That doesn't mean going to Harvard. It simply means lifelong, purposive learning and lots of reading. Number seven, stable, long-term relationships. For most, this is a steady marriage, but there are other relationships that can fit here. The point is having people with whom you grow together, whom you can count on no matter what comes your way. Seven goals isn't so many, but it's handy to know the most important one thing to remember. That boiling down process can be extremely helpful to focus the mind. Is it the smoking, drinking, or exercise? No. According to George Valiant, the single most important trait of happy well elders is healthy relationships. As he puts it, happiness is love, full stop. He elaborates a little. There are two pillars of happiness. One is love, the other is finding a way of coping with life that does not push love away. And just for good measure, he quotes Virgil, "Omnia vincit amor." Love conquers all. Valiant's successor, Robert Waldinger, puts it this way. The lessons aren't about wealth or fame or working harder and harder. The clearest message that we get from this study is this. Good relationships keep us happier and healthier. Period. Further, the people who were the most satisfied in their relationships at age 50 were the healthiest at age 80. All the lonely people. Just focus on love. Sounds simple, doesn't it? It isn't. Not for a lot of people, especially strivers who have worked their whole lives for worldly success, but whose relationships have withered over the years and who are now quite isolated. Loneliness is not the same as being alone, of course, because one can be emotionally and socially connected to others while alone. In fact, being alone is critical to one's emotional well-being and peace of mind. Some people, not me, but one of my kids, for example, are happiest by themselves, as long as they have healthy social and emotional connections. The theologian and philosopher Paul Tillich put it like this in his classic book, The Eternal Now. Solitude expresses the glory of being alone, whereas loneliness expresses the pain of feeling alone. Loneliness is the experience of emotional and social isolation. It has the weird property of being utterly ubiquitous, yet feeling completely unique. The novelist Thomas Wolfe wrote in his essay, God's Lonely Man, "The whole conviction of my life now rests upon the belief that loneliness, far from being a rare and curious phenomenon, is the central and inevitable fact of human existence. Lonely people feel like they are the only ones who feel lonely. They feel lonely in their very loneliness." Just because it's common, however, doesn't mean loneliness is harmless. Research has established that the stress it creates leads to lowered immunity to disease, insomnia, cognitive sluggishness, and higher blood pressure. Lonely people tend toward high-calorie, high-fat diets and lead more sedentary lives than non-lonely people. In her book, The Lonely Century, Norina Hertz shows that in terms of health outcomes, loneliness is comparable to smoking 15 cigarettes per day and is worse than obesity. It is also strongly associated with cognitive decline and dementia. No surprise, then, that health officials are taking notice of loneliness as a public health threat. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy has written a book about this, which starts with these words. "During my years caring for patients, the most common condition I saw was not heart disease or diabetes. It was loneliness." And indeed, one doctor I interviewed for this book told me that he has longtime patients, often very successful people, who come to him basically just to have someone to talk to with whom they can be completely honest. The U.S. Health Resources and Services Administration has declared a loneliness epidemic, specifically citing the increasing phenomena of no participation in social groups, fewer friends, and strained relationships as the culprits. For healthcare companies, loneliness is driving up costs. The insurance company Cigna has devoted significant resources to understanding why social isolation is increasing, finding that in 2018, 46% of Americans felt alone, and 43% of Americans felt that their relationships were not meaningful. Not everyone suffers equally from loneliness, of course. Some have a natural proclivity for it. Others have life circumstances that would make them more isolated than others. While gender and age aren't good predictors, marital status matters. Married people are less lonely than those who are divorced, widowed, and never married. However, the loneliest of all are those who are married but with an absent spouse. Workaholics, take note. Your spouse is probably lonely and suffering as a result. And retirement? I have looked into whether people get lonelier after they retire and found that some do, but only those who tended toward loneliness to begin with. In other words, the kind of people who don't know how to manage social interactions outside of work get lonelier when they retire. That describes a lot of successful people I know. You might wonder which jobs and careers are the loneliest. It makes sense that you would find lonely people in professions where people spend a lot of time by themselves. I thought about farmers, for example. After high school, one of my sons took a job farming wheat in Idaho, and I remember that during harvest, he would spend 14 hours a day alone in a combine. At other times, he would be by himself all day, fixing fences and picking boulders out of the soil. He was almost always alone. But my son, who is highly social, never complained about feeling lonely. And in fact, his off hours were nearly always spent with his friends and the family who owned the farm. Then I thought about people in sales. Hotel to hotel, airport to airport. It has to be horribly lonely, right? It turns out neither farmers nor traveling salespeople are on the list of loneliest jobs. The two loneliest professions, according to the Harvard Business Review, are lawyers and doctors. Both of these are high skill, high pay, high prestige professions. Maybe something like yours. The lonely leader. Earlier, we talked about the fact that successful, upwardly mobile people are the ones most prone to suffering when their skills start to decline. It surprises people to hear this, but it shouldn't. After all, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. A similar principle applies to loneliness, which is a special malady for people who have enjoyed a lot of worldly success. Sometimes examples of this are celebrities known to all of us but close to no one. Take celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain, for example. I was always kind of a fan of his. Not that I care so much about food. I just thought his television shows, No Reservations and Parts Unknown, were exquisitely beautiful and was amazed how he used something as prosaic as eating to introduce viewers to the world. What a fun life he must have, I thought. And indeed, I have the best job in the world, he told The New Yorker in an interview. If I'm unhappy, it's a failure of imagination. You probably know where I'm going here. On June 8th, 2018, Bourdain hanged himself in a hotel room in France where he was filming an episode of his show. I didn't know much about Bourdain's private life. Out of professional rather than prurient interest, I read articles about what might have contributed to the self-destruction of someone who seemed to have it all. In the explanations that emerged, he had a drinking problem, he had relationship issues, and so forth. The two characteristics I saw over and over again were his workaholism and what one author called his unfathomable loneliness. Bourdain worked brutally long hours, year after year. He was always surrounded by others, but by all accounts, connected at a deep human level with very few. But it isn't just world-famous people who wind up feeling isolated and lonely. Plenty of ordinary high achievers do as well. Wrapped up in their fear of falling behind, success-addicted workaholics, like all people controlled by their addictive behavior, leave little room in their lives for friends or family. As the late John Cacioppo, the University of Chicago social neuroscientist and pioneer in the study of loneliness, put it, loneliness reflects how you feel about your relationships. So even though they may be in a family or a crowded workplace, workaholics feel all alone, except for their terrible, beloved work. Leaders are particularly prone to loneliness, in no small part because real friendships at work are difficult or impossible with people under one's authority and supervision. Work friendships are so important that 70% of people say friendship at work is the most important element to a happy work life, and 58% say they would turn down a higher-paying job if it meant not getting along with coworkers. According to a data analysis conducted by Gallup in 2020, employees who say they have a best friend at work are almost twice as likely as others to enjoy their workday and almost 50% more likely to report high social well-being. But people at the top often miss out on true workplace friendships and suffer mightily as a result. According to one finding in the Harvard Business Review, for example, half of CEOs experience loneliness on the job, and most of them feel loneliness hinders their work performance. Studies also have shown that loneliness is linked to burnout among leaders. Loneliness at the top doesn't come from physical isolation. Who spends more time in meetings than a CEO? But from an inability to make deep human connections at work as a result of the leader's position. At work, successful people are lonely in a crowd. A study by Princeton psychologist Daniel Kahneman and colleagues provides a clue as to why leaders are isolated. The researchers asked a large group of working women to reconstruct their day to ascertain the moments that yield the highest levels of positive and negative emotion. The positive side of the ledger yielded few surprises. The top three activities were, in order, sex, socializing, and relaxing. The top three happiness-inducing interaction partners were friends, relatives, and spouse, which seem out of order given the activities list, but no matter. The top three activities for producing negative feelings were working, childcare, and commuting. Sorry, kids. The second and third most negative interaction partners were clients and coworkers. But the top spot for negative interactions? The boss. No one wants to hang around with the lonely boss. That explained a lot for me, especially after I started digging deeper into the reasons. One famous study from 1972 found that subordinates in a workplace tend to lose their sense of free will about being friends with a boss. You're unfriendly to him or her at your peril, which makes things uncomfortable and weird. More recent research has shown that subordinates objectify leaders by seeing them not as people per se, but as dispensers of power, information, and money. But even if employees don't endow the boss with negative qualities, they can make the relationship awkward and unfun. One study from 2003 found that subordinates in the workplace often treat their superiors like authority figures from their childhood, such as parents or teachers. Even if they don't refer to the boss as mommy, this makes peer-to-peer friendship impossible and leaves the boss, who might be a former colleague, socially alone. People with authority isolate themselves as well. The authors of the famous 1950 book, The Lonely Crowd, claim that leaders are lonely because their success requires manipulation and persuasion of others. As such, they objectify subordinates every bit as much as subordinates objectify them. Later research found that leaders often purposely distance themselves from employees so they can appraise their performance fairly. In plain terms, if you might have to fire someone, you're unlikely to form tight bonds with that person. Romance and friendship. The relationships that best mitigate loneliness, the aspens closest to us that we need to cultivate, are romantic partnerships and close friendships. Let's take a look at each and then see why strivers so often neglect them. There's a lot of research on why some romantic relationships are stable and others are not. It is well known that a big percentage of all marriages in the United States end in divorce or separation, about 39%, according to the latest data. But staying together is not what really counts. Analysis of the Harvard study data shows that marriage per se accounts for only 2% of subjective well-being later in life. The important thing for health and well-being is relationship satisfaction. Popular culture would have you believe the secret to this satisfaction is romantic passion. But that's wrong. On the contrary, a lot of unhappiness can attend the early stages of romance. For example, researchers find that it is often accompanied by rumination, jealousy, and surveillance behaviors, not what we typically associate with happiness. Furthermore, destiny beliefs about soulmates or love being meant to be can predict low forgiveness when paired with attachment anxiety. Romance often hijacks our brains in a way that can cause the highs of elation or the depths of despair. You might accurately say that falling in love is the startup cost for happiness, an exhilarating but stressful stage we have to endure to get to relationships that actually fulfill us. The secret to happiness isn't falling in love, it's staying in love, which depends on what psychologists call companionate love. Love based less on passionate highs and lows and more on stable affection, mutual understanding, and commitment. You might think companionate love sounds a little, well, disappointing. I certainly did the first time I heard it, on the heels of great efforts to win my future wife's love. But over the past 30 years, it turns out that we don't just love each other, we like each other too. Once and always my romantic love, she's also my best friend. Being rooted in friendship is the reason that companionate love creates true happiness. Passionate love, which relies on attraction, does not typically last beyond the novelty stage of the relationship. Companionate love relies on its very familiarity. As one researcher bluntly summarizes the evidence in the Journal of Happiness Studies, the well-being benefits of marriage are much greater for those who also regard their spouse as their best friend. This is the kind of love that perseveres across crises, over time, and thus that delivers the happy well benefits. Best friends get enjoyment, satisfaction, and meaning from each other's company. They bring out the best in each other. They gently tease each other. They have fun together. President Calvin Coolidge and his wife Grace famously had such a friendship. According to one story, perhaps apocryphal, when the president and the first lady were touring a poultry farm, Mrs. Coolidge remarked to the farmer, loud enough for the president to hear, that it was amazing so many eggs were fertilized by just one rooster. The farmer told her that the roosters did their jobs over and over again each day. "Perhaps you could point that out to Mr. Coolidge," she told him with a smile. The president, noting the remark, inquired whether the rooster serviced the same hen each time. "No," the farmer told him, "there were many hens for each rooster." "Perhaps you could point that out to Mrs. Coolidge," said the president. Promiscuous roosters notwithstanding, the romance of companionate love seems to make people happiest when it's monogamous. I say this as a social scientist, not a moralist. In 2004, a survey of 16,000 American adults found that for men and women alike, the happiness-maximizing number of sexual partners in the previous year is calculated to be 1. Your romantic partnership is arguably your most important relationship. However, it is neither necessary nor sufficient to prevent loneliness. Robert Waldinger has told me that, in fact, He sees no difference in happiness between senior citizens who are married and those who remain single that owes to marriage per se. You can be single and happy if you have other close, fulfilling family links and friendships. But equally important, your marriage cannot be your